Universities have entire departments aimed at recruiting and admitting students, and that investment is paying off. More students than ever are starting their freshman year, with 70% of high school seniors matriculating to four-year colleges. But while college recruitment has steadily increased, the retention rate remains stagnant. One in five freshmen do not return for their sophomore semesters. That's over a million students a year dropping out of college. These surprising figures have aimed a spotlight on the problem of retention in higher education and have spurred politicians, administrators, and journalists to ask, how can we ensure college students are finishing the degrees that they start? John Marcus, higher education editor at the Hechinger Report and author of a recent article on the issue, joins us today to discuss the crisis of retention in higher education. John, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So tell me, what is retention and why is it such an important concern right now?
So I think that one of the reasons people haven't paid attention to retention is because it's one of those wonky words that people use in higher education. Essentially, it means the proportion of students who stay. And we've focused a lot on getting people to go to college, and we've focused a lot on getting people to graduate from college. And the sort of squishy part in the middle is what retention is, how many people stay and how many people leave. And a staggering number of people leave. One in five, as you mentioned in your intro, one in five students don't come back for a sophomore year.
And what are the costs to universities when a student starts freshman year and then disappears and leaves?
Yeah, so it depends on the type of university, but this is costing billions of dollars. On average, it costs a typical university $13 million a year in foregone revenue when students leave. Collectively, it's costing us as a country $16.5 billion a year. That includes money that we as taxpayers contribute to financial aid for these students and also to the cost of subsidizing public universities.
And what are the costs to individual students? What does it mean for a student who leaves after freshman year? Where are they going and what are the costs to them?
Yeah, those costs are significant. So assuming that they stop their educations, they've lost the year that they could have been out there earning money. Instead, they've been spending money on an education that hasn't led to a degree. Many of them will finish in debt and not have a degree, so they're still working a low-wage job, and now they have a college loan to repay. So it's a lose-lose. There's damage all around.
And when they drop out, do they just give up on the prospect of higher education in the future, or do they maybe go back several years later? Is there a general scenario?
Well, this is hard to know because the way we track students in America is not entirely reliable. So, for example, a student may transfer or eventually finish somewhere else, and we lose track of them. So it's completely feasible that some of these students will eventually get a degree, that some of these one out of five students that quit their first college experience will go back. But it's also logical to assume that a lot of them will kind of sour on the idea of a higher education. They, for one reason or other, didn't like college, didn't feel comfortable there, and left, which means it's really unlikely they're going to go back and try again, on top of which it's going to be more difficult now for them to afford to do that. And another huge problem in American higher education is that credits, academic credits, often do not transfer. So students, when they transfer from one institution to another, lose on average an entire semester's worth of credits that they've already earned and paid for. So all of those things make it challenging for students to keep going. So it's likely that a lot of these students just drop out and we never see them again.
Wow. And this is 1 million students every single year. If they're not going back to school, do we know anything about what happens to them? Are they entering the workforce? Are they unemployed? Where do they go?
We don't know, but it's likely that they're underemployed. It's likely that they're working in some field that does not require a degree. It's possible that they go on and get some other kind of post-secondary education. That could be an apprenticeship. They could go into a blue-collar skill, which frankly in many cases pay as much as what people make with bachelor's degrees. We've written a lot about this too. A lot of students, incidentally, and I hope we'll talk about why students leave, because that's a big part of this story. A lot of students leave because they never knew why they went to college in the first place. As you also mentioned at the outset, we've done a lot of work to encourage students in high school to go on to college. And a lot of them get there, and I've talked to them, and they say, I really don't know why I'm here. They can't figure out a major. They don't know what they want to do for a career. And they sort of get lost between the cracks. One of the other ramifications of the fact that we send so many kids to college is that we're running out of people in a lot of other fields where there are retirements looming, and those include things like electricians and plumbers and iron workers, automotive repair people who make a great deal of money and whose education costs them a lot less. I visited, for another story, some iron workers in the Pacific Northwest where there's all kinds of building going on, largely fueled by the tech industry, and where there's a huge shortage of iron workers. The iron workers were earning $50,000 a year to learn how to be iron workers, and they were laughing about their friends in college spending a fortune for degrees they weren't even sure they wanted. So, to answer your question more succinctly, no, we don't really know where they go, and we can kind of assume the worst.
So who is doing this encouraging to go to college as opposed to going into a trade and working with your hands and making money right off the bat in high school? Who is doing that encouraging, and what does the encouragement look like?
I'm not sure it's as much of a who as a what. I think it's a cultural encouragement. I think we as a culture have come to believe that a college degree is the ladder to success, and that is still, frankly, true. I mean, you're going to make a lot more money with a college degree than you are without one, even as an iron worker. But parents, because they buy into that and want the best for their children, for all the best reasons, encourage their children to go on to college. College counselors, high schools are often ranked based on their success in encouraging students to go to college. Actually, I had lunch with some friends yesterday who teach at a private school and who were talking about that. I said, what percentage of your graduates go to college? And they said, it depends who you ask, because the high school wants their success rate to look as robust as they can, and they're pushing students to go on to college. So this happens just sort of all around us, and we're just giving these students this impression that if they don't go to college, then they're failures. Even if you live in places like New York or Boston, where I'm talking to you from, where the decal on the back of the window of your car is a huge status symbol, where your kid goes to college. So all of that is kind of part of this culture that has propelled students into bachelor's degrees that some of them don't even know they want.
So they got to college, and then they wonder, why am I here? Or some of them do, at least. What are then some of the reasons that they gave you for leaving?
Well, so some of these reasons are anecdotal, and some of them are empirical. So there has been research. One of the huge problems with retention is that it's not entirely – there are some things you can blame the universities for – but you can't blame them for everything, because it's really hard to know a student's going to leave until they're gone. And so, when you quit a job, you give 2 weeks' notice and you do an exit interview. These colleges typically don't know why their students leave. But there has been some research, and there have been a few surveys that at least one college actually shared with us, where they went back and found all of their students that had disappeared and asked them why. As you can imagine, given that particular group of students, the response rate wasn't very high, but it was high enough to get a pretty good sense. So here's some of the reasons that you get. Number one, and this one is fairly obvious, is financial. They run out of money. In this case, the universities are complicit because, although many people aren't aware of this, they often will offer you a certain amount of financial aid to come in and enroll as a freshman. By the time you get to sophomore year, they're going to offer you less financial aid. This in the industry is actually known as a bait and switch. And unfortunately, a lot of students who are on the edge can't afford to come back when they see what the second year offer is. But it's often too late for them to transfer. Transferring, as I mentioned earlier, is very complicated. So a lot of students just throw up their hands and say, I'm already in debt. They're giving me less financial aid. I can't come back. Family obligations are the second biggest reason that we see in some of these surveys and research. A family member, a breadwinner, loses a job or gets sick or dies, and the student has to go back and get a job and help make ends meet. Another major reason, and this one comes both from survey work, but also I hear this a lot at universities, and not just large universities, but small ones too, especially in an era of helicopter parents. When a student ends up at a college, there's an extraordinary sense of isolation in some cases. Not everyone adjusts well to that environment. And a lot of students feel lonely, and you've seen a lot, incidentally, of increase in mental health services provided at colleges, in part in response to this. So isolation is another big reason. Students just feel friendless and alone, and they leave, and some universities are intervening in this by connecting students with what they call a cohort of fellow students in a class so that they all kind of keep an eye on each other and make friends quickly and have other people they can talk to. What it isn't, and I think this is extraordinarily important when we talk about this issue, it is not necessarily that they're leaving college not necessarily because they can't hack it academically. 40% of the students that leave college have a B or better, a 3.0 grade point average or better, which is really good, especially for freshmen. And they still leave. So it's not because they can't hack it academically, but some of them can't hack it socially or financially, or they have some family obligation that draws them home.
I can imagine the isolation of going into a college of, say, 30,000 students, and that some students just getting lost, not knowing how to build relationships and form attachments and just wanting to go back home. I imagine that's some of what came through in the survey.
This is a big problem because it takes a particular toll in exactly the kind of students who we want to encourage to go to college. So first-generation and low-income students, especially really smart ones that end up at selective universities and colleges and look around and don't see anybody else like them, because selective colleges notoriously have very small proportions of low-income students. In many of the Ivies, about 12% of the students are low-income. So you're surrounded by, and I've talked to many students in this situation, surrounded by people who come from an entirely different background from you, who aren't struggling financially, whose parents went to college. So that creates a sense of isolation among people who we really want to see succeed. Another really interesting group of students that this affects is rural students. And as with pretty much everything else that journalists cover, education writers kind of didn't pay attention to rural America until the last election, quite honestly, when we all started remembering that there was another America that we weren't paying attention to. And as we did, we found that rural high school students have very high graduation rates. They're very smart. They do really well on national standardized tests. But they have the lowest college-going rate of any kind of students in America, including non-white urban students. White rural students in every income level go to college at lower rates than urban non-white students. So I spoke with a student from southern Iowa who did go to college. He went to the University of Iowa, which is a very large campus with a lot of students. And he said, one of the first things he said was there were more students in some of his introductory classes than there were people in his hometown.
Wow.
And so it was extraordinarily disorienting. He stuck it out, but I've spoken to other people that work with rural college students who say that they leave at extraordinarily high rates. And in fact, first-generation students in particular are among those who leave the most.
That's got to be quite an adjustment. If you're just joining us, I'm talking to John Marcus, higher education editor at the Hechinger Report and author of a recent article on that very issue of higher education and retaining students who drop out of college. John, are there any strategies that these colleges are employing for keeping first-generation students, students whose parents did not go to college, for keeping them specifically in the classroom?
Yes, colleges are employing them. Nonprofits outside of college campuses are employing them, and the students themselves are organizing themselves into groups for mutual support. So colleges are, it's hard to really generalize about this, but some colleges are providing additional support for first-generation students, additional advising, coaching, mentoring. So are some nonprofits that involve themselves from the point at which students begin to consider in high school going to college, because even that process is extraordinarily complex. And a lot of first-generation students whose parents didn't go to college don't know how to fill out the federal financial aid form. In fact, even with a great deal of additional emphasis on that that form, it's called the FAFSA. It's a free form that people fill out to see how much financial aid they're going to get. The number of students who are filling it out is very, very low and increased a tiny, tiny fraction of a percent this year, even with all of the interventions that are being thrown at it. So coaching, mentorship, and one of the most effective things that we're seeing is that students themselves are organizing themselves into groups and clubs and associations. So there is some work, some intervention being done around that. And for other underrepresented groups like rural students, a few states are beginning to reach out to rural students and a few universities. The University of Georgia just announced a big scholarship program for, well, a scholarship program for rural students. It's not that big. It will assist 24 students a year. So kind of a drop in the bucket, but at least a start.
But I imagine that despite these recent efforts, there's still a lot more money spent on trying to recruit students to go to college than money spent on keeping students in college. Is that right?
Because that's what colleges have always been rewarded for. Mm-hmm. Most public universities have historically been budgeted based on the number of students they have, not on the number of students who graduate. That's changing, and that's one of the reasons that you are beginning to see. So there's kind of a happy ending to this story, or at least some good news. That is that universities are beginning to pay attention to it. And they're beginning to pay attention to it, I guess, partly because it's the right thing to do, but mostly because it's in their own best interests. So public universities increasingly are being budgeted based on rates of success, not just number of students. So they now have to prove that they're that they have a certain level of persistence, that students are staying and completing courses and eventually graduating, or else their budgets are affected. The principal reason that they're paying attention to it is that they're running out of students. There's been a massive, and this is something else that people in general outside of higher education, and in fact, I find some people inside higher education aren't aware of, there are 2.9 million fewer college students than there were at the last peak in 2011. Huh. Partly for demographic reasons, and it's most acute here in the Northeast and in the Midwest. And those are two parts of the country, if you think about it, that are oversaturated with colleges, big colleges, small liberal arts colleges. You're beginning to see those small colleges close or face a lot of financial pressure, and that's because demographics are such, the birth rate is such that there are fewer 18-year-olds going into college. While the proportion of high school graduates is up, the actual number of high school graduates is down. And so colleges are all sort of fighting for those students. Where it used to be easy to replace a dropout, it's gotten much more complicated. So in their own best interest, they are now trying to hold on to these students because it's expensive to replace them. We spoke about the cost of the foregone revenue, tuition revenue. That's also incentivizing them to pay attention to retention. And employers, especially in parts of the country where the unemployment rate is very, very low, it's low everywhere, but in places like Colorado, there's a huge shortage of workers, and especially credentialed workers. So employers are putting a lot of pressure on colleges to turn out more students, more graduates, and to do that, they have to keep them and keep them from leaving. I visited a campus in northern Texas that we found by looking through the data that we used to do this story. This particular campus, and I'd love to say this is unusual, but we found a number of campuses with these kinds of numbers. Between the freshman year and sophomore year, 55% of their students left.
Wow.
55% of their students didn't come back for a second year. And they have begun to move that needle by, you walk around the campus and you see advising everywhere, and you see special programs for black male students, and you see, you talk to students who say that they get phone calls from their advisors to just check in on them and see how they're doing. So colleges are paying a great deal more attention to this because they have to for financial reasons.
55% who drop out after freshman year is just an extraordinary number for one campus.
It's an extraordinary number when you think about the success rate in general of American higher education, and this also is something that I think people largely don't know. When you cover higher education, you tend to see this, and you slap your forehead a lot, and you tend also not to get invited to dinner parties because you bring this up and it's boring. But
you can come to my dinners, John.
Yeah, okay.
Feel free.
Only about just around 60% now of students who go to college graduate within 6 years. Not 4 years, but 6 years.
Wow.
And so if you were a private business and you had a 60% success rate, you'd be out of business. And so that's a massive problem. It's also an extraordinarily expensive one for taxpayers who subsidize these campuses and for students themselves who think they're going to finish in 4 years. And at best, if they're lucky, they'll finish in six. That's 50% more money than they thought they'd spend on college. 89% of students in an annual survey, a national survey that's done by UCLA, 89% of incoming freshmen say they expect to finish college in 4 years, and only 43% of them actually finish in 4 years. So there's a massive disconnect that leads to a lot of expense.
You mentioned a school in Texas where there's particular efforts to reach out to black students. Do black and minority and foreign-born students face a unique challenge when it comes to staying in school and not dropping out after freshman year?
Well, so race often correlates with income, and so low-income students, yes, often succumb to two of those major reasons people leave. One is the financial reason, and one is also family obligations. It is, again, empirical that within the Hispanic population in particular, students are found to be reluctant to go to college very far away from home, and so that affects them. So what you see happen, and one of the reasons that this does disproportionately affect low-income and racial minority students, is that those students, even the smartest kids of every race, some of them will choose for financial reasons to go to the least expensive institutions, and those will be community colleges and sort of second-tier public universities. And those institutions also are very thinly stretched financially. They are poorly resourced. They don't have the level of support that, for example, an elite nonprofit, private nonprofit institution might have. And so those students who are at the most risk get the least help, and they tend to leave at the higher numbers.
A lot of students who are of a racial or ethnic minority are often placed in remedial math and English courses, right? So that can also be maybe a blow to self-esteem. Maybe they don't feel like they're a part of the larger student community when they're put in those courses. Is that a part of the issue for those particular students?
Yes, and they're also very time-consuming, and they don't you don't get credit for them, and you have to pay. So you're paying for a non-credit course. So a couple of states, California and Florida, are trying to get rid of that those remedial courses. They're also called developmental education, and replacing it with a sort of an on-the-run extra tutoring. So students, even students that need remedial education, are placed into regular college-level classes, but they have sort of outside support and outside coaching and outside tutoring to make sure they stay on track. There are some people, including some university presidents in places where this is being piloted, who are very concerned about whether this is the right way to go, because they want to make sure these students really do have a grasp of the subject area. I spoke to a university president in California who said if she has a student that wants to major in engineering, she really wants to make sure he knows how to do calculus. And if the kid shows up without math skills but is allowed to go ahead and start college-level courses, she worries that that might not be true. So we'll see how those experiments work. But, yes, remedial education is a huge and discouraging and frustrating barrier for a lot of students.
So what are some of the solutions in your mind going forward to increase the retention rate at colleges? Should students, for example, be forced to declare a major earlier on? Should some potential college students be redirected to other options like technical schools where they can get higher paying jobs right out of high school? I mean, how does America and these institutions solve this problem?
Those are two really good potential ways of addressing it. There are a number of other interventions that people are trying, sort of throwing everything at this problem. So here are a few. In some majors, the number of required credits has crept up because some member of the faculty did a doctoral thesis on some sort of obscure, ephemeral, sort of related topic and wants it to be a required course and not an elective. If you go to college and take 15 credits a semester, which most students, frankly, don't do, then you're going to be able to finish 120 credits and graduate in 4 years. The problem is some majors now require more than 120 credits.
What kind of majors? Like all different kinds of majors or science majors?
Engineering. Majors like that, which engineering in particular is notorious for being sort of a five-year major. But even some other majors that, you might not expect, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but they require more credits than it's reasonable to expect a student can accumulate in 4 years. And if the student only takes 12 credits in the first semester, they're already behind schedule. So that's one problem. Another problem is just generally, rather than looking at the solutions, one of the ways to address the solutions is to look at why the problems are there. And one of the reasons that the problems are there are because universities historically weren't necessarily set up for students. There's this old adage that I've heard people repeat at the beginning of every higher education conference that I've ever been at, that it used to be they'd line you up in your freshman year and they'd tell you to look on your left and look on your right, and one of those people wouldn't be there anymore in the second year. That was sort of a point of pride, that universities would weed you out if you weren't smart enough to finish. And that university in Texas that I visited, the president there used that example and said, no more. It's not allowed for a member of the faculty to say, my course is the course that weeds out the students that can't make it. Instead, they need to intervene with the students who can't make it and help them make it. That's a big cultural difference. There's a group of community colleges that I find, this is really fascinating and hasn't gotten a lot of attention. We've written about them. Every summer they bring a bunch of community college presidents and they meet with a private business that is famous for customer service. So they've met with Disney and Southwest Airlines and other companies that have very, very highly ranked customer service. And the university presidents meet with them to learn about how to make their campuses more consumer friendly. Using the word consumer to describe a student all by itself offends a lot of people in higher education, but that's what students are. They're consumers. So they learn, for example, I believe it's Disney that has this thing, and it's also true at Whole Foods. They have this rule that the employee can't leave the customer until the customer's question is satisfactorily answered. So some community colleges that have attended these events have gone back and made sure that when a kid goes to the registrar doesn't say, well, you filled out that form wrong, and slams the window shut and points to another office, but actually helps the kid do it. Or that faculty pay attention. I'm working on this story now. You would assume that a faculty member who sees a student struggling in his or her class would intervene, but faculty traditionally haven't done that. And a lot of colleges and universities are beginning to intervene with their faculty and train them to do that.
Thanks so much, John. I really appreciate it. We have to go, but really appreciate you joining me today. I'm Matt Katz, and I've been speaking with John Marcus, higher education editor at the Hechinger Report, about his recent article, More High School Grads Than Ever Are Going to College, But 1 in 5 Will Quit.